From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. As we mark 6 months since the first coronavirus case here in the U.S., Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti says he's considering a second stay-at-home order while cases across the country near 4 million.
And as COVID-19 cases surge, parents and teachers and school systems across the country are trying to figure out whether or not to send kids back to school. Let's check in Florida, where the state's largest teachers union, the Florida Education Association, is suing over that state's order to fully reopen all public schools next month. As the association was filing their suit yesterday, Florida's coronavirus cases topped 10,000 for the sixth day in a row. The president of the Florida Education Association is Frederick Ingram. Frederick, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, your lawsuit says that the state, Florida, is in violation of one of its constitutional mandates, specifically to keep public schools safe and secure. Just elaborate on that.
Sure. So we have COVID cases that are skyrocketing in the form of 10,000 plus in the state of Florida over the last 6 days. But the startling issue for us is 23,000 kids that have tested positive in the state of Florida for COVID-19 with a positivity rate of 13.4%. We as a state cannot ensure the safe and secure situations in our schools for our kids. And so what we're asking the governor to do is back off of this executive order that was issued by our commissioner of education that says we must have a brick and mortar option, that schools must start up by August 31st. And it also attaches punitive damages to school districts who do not comply with this particular issue in the executive order. And so we need the governor to slow down. Let's press the pause button. Let's get this virus right so that our schools can not only open, but can stay open.
Well, you know, the governor has shifted this over to his Department of Education. He says it is their plan. But they're also saying that schools are, you know, also where kids get nutrition, counseling, sometimes air conditioning. They say that the risks of having a lot of kids not in school outweigh the risks of COVID-19. You say what?
The very same children who are vulnerable to going into these schools, children from poor communities, children that are black and brown, are going to be the very people who are hurt the most, because these are the young students who cannot go back home and quarantine because of confined spaces. These are the young people who cannot go and isolate themselves or isolate themselves from a multi-generational home if a COVID outbreak happens at a particular school because they don't have the room in their house to isolate. And so we don't have a testing, tracking, and isolation plan for these students. And I believe that this is a life or death situation. I believe that one life lost to a reopening of our schools is one too many, because this is a problem that we can absolutely solve. It has been solved around this world as different countries have entered back into schools. But let's start slowly. If we have a spread like in Miami-Dade County or Broward or West Palm Beach, give them the option to go to virtual. Give them the option to do hybrid models, but don't force them to have a brick and mortar option in order to get monies from the state.
Well, and there are funds tied to this request, and that's the other thing the Department of Education says. You're foolishly giving up those funds. You are holding to your belief that health trumps the funding. And other schools have adjusted. In Los Angeles, schools will remain virtual this fall, but that's after 83% of teachers in the LA Teachers Union said they were against returning. What if Florida is less responsive? What will your next move be? I mean, do you think it's time for a strike? Some teachers across the country are saying it's time for a national strike.
But we don't believe that this is about withholding our labor. During this time, teachers want to go to school. They want to go to work. Our cafeteria workers, our bus drivers, our paraprofessionals, the educational village, around this time, every single year, teachers and others get giddy about decorating their classrooms, doing professional development, coming up with ideas that are going to be the best practices for educating our kids. We simply want to go back to work. This is not about wanting to be out, but we need to do this safely. We know that we're the epicenter in the state of Florida for this virus. We have numbers that are raging out of control, 360,000 total positive cases here in the state of Florida, over 5,000 deaths, a double-digit positivity rate, and 12 areas in the state of Florida, rural and urban, the federal government has identified as hotspots. And so our schools are going to be a microcosm of what's happening out there in the world. Because what we're doing with COVID-19 in our state, we've been reckless with beaches, we've been reckless with bars, and we've been reckless with restaurants. We cannot be reckless with our public schools.
Frederick Ingram, president of the Florida Education Association, that's the state's largest teachers union, and they're suing the state for its request to reopen schools next month. Frederick, thank you.
Thank you so much.
President Trump is threatening to send federal agents to major U.S. cities, including Philadelphia, Oakland, and Detroit, to clamp down on anti-racism protests and other violence. He makes that threat as the Chicago Tribune and the Associated Press reports the administration already has plans in the works to send 150 law enforcement agents to Chicago. There's been growing national controversy over the use of federal force in U.S. cities, sparked by federal agents patrolling the streets of Portland, Oregon. Trump yesterday told this to reporters.
Well, I'm going to do something that I can tell you, because we're not going to let New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Detroit and Baltimore and all of these, Oakland is a mess. We're not going to let this happen in our country. All run by liberal Democrats.
And more federal law enforcement.
We're going to have more federal law enforcement, that I can tell you.
We're joined now by Michigan Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Lieutenant Governor, Detroit is one of the cities that the president mentioned where he may send federal troops in to combat violence. Even though there hasn't been large-scale violence during protests in the city, what's your response?
It's just the latest demonstration that President Trump is completely out of touch with the people of Detroit and the people of the state of Michigan. Those who have been demonstrating, including myself and Governor Whitmer, we have marched with demonstrators calling for racial justice. The people who are demonstrating respect the changes and the reforms that they're seeking. And so they've been peaceful and they've been forceful, but they have not been violent. And so for the president to threaten to bring the same kind of, you know, federal kidnapping campaign that he's brought to the city of Portland, to Detroit, is reprehensible and it's disgusting to me. And so that's why we have made a very strong statement about how unacceptable that is and how out of touch that is with the people of Michigan. It's exactly the wrong answer. He wants to try to tamp out something that doesn't exist rather than trying to do the work at the federal level to stamp out something that does exist and that is killing Black people, which is the COVID-19 pandemic. And he's ignored that and instead doubling down on the fear and the threats that he always defaults to.
You say doubling down on the fear, but the Detroit police chief did speak yesterday about a wave of gun violence over the weekend. I believe 7 people were killed in shootings. But give us a view from the State House. I mean, this may not be the problem that he's talking about in regards to large-scale violence during anti-racism protests. But is there any truth to the president's claim that Detroit needs to control violence and bring federal agents in specifically?
Well, I can give you the view from the city of Detroit, where I live and where I'm talking with you from. And it's that we are continuing to work to understand how to improve public safety across the city and, frankly, across the state. And so there's always work that's happening at the community level to do that. And we have seen some more shootings, fatal and non-fatal. And I know that community leaders and law enforcement are working on that. That's not what the president's talking about. The president wants to connect this to people who are speaking out for a different future when it comes to public safety. And the president couldn't be more wrong. We don't need federal support in terms of jackbooted people coming to sweep people off in the vans. Instead, we need federal investment. We need the federal government to step up and make states and local governments like the city of Detroit, as there have been big holes blown in the budget to respond to COVID-19, and instead making resources available to people for housing and education. That would be something that the federal government could do that would be useful, and that ultimately would tamp down public safety because our communities would be invested in the right way.
Hmm. There are questions about whether this is even legal, although experts point out that the Department of Homeland Security does have the broad authority to enforce federal laws. At this point, is there anything the state or Detroit officials could do if the president does send in federal law enforcement?
Well, what we're doing right now is trying to get out ahead of this by making it clear that this is unwarranted, unnecessary, and this is dangerous for our communities. By the president even threatening to do this, he is escalating the violence in the communities at the very same violence he says that he wants to tamp down. But that's because he doesn't actually want to tamp down violence. So we're going to do everything we can to try to get out ahead of this and stay out ahead of this. But this kind of lack of accountability is something that we shouldn't tolerate from the federal government. And we're going to do everything we can and looking at whatever legal remedies we have, et cetera, to try to block this from happening.
Your state's attorney general says the president is using his power to punish people he disagrees with, in this case, Democrats. This comes at a moment when the president is trailing in the polls. Do you see this as political?
Absolutely. The defining characteristic of the Trump presidency is the abuse of power against people the president doesn't like or who he fears don't like him. He knows that he has virtually no support in the city of Detroit and amongst black people in Detroit. So it's not surprising that then he would threaten Detroiters with violence. And frankly, it's why this election is so important, why people need to organize and get out and vote, to vote this man out of office and vote in Joe Biden, someone who is actually empathetic to our communities and wants to invest in them, not threaten them.
That's Michigan Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya. Be safe.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now. Where independent minds get their start.
Jim Carrey is known for comedies like The Mask, Dumb and Dumber, and classics like The Truman Show, where he played a man who discovers his entire life is being filmed and watched by a worldwide audience. Now Carrey has author next to his name. His new book is titled Memoirs and Misinformation, but it's anything but a typical memoir. Instead, the novel, which Carrey co-wrote with Dana Vachon, centers around a character named Jim Carrey, who happens to also be a successful comedian, on a quest for relevance and artistic recognition. There's also a lot of name-dropping in this piece of fiction, stars like Nicolas Cage and Gwyneth Paltrow, and the character Carrey is dealing with a troubled love life, wildfires, and the possibility of an apocalypse. Memoirs and Misinformation debuted on the New York Times bestseller list this week. And joining me now are Jim Carrey and Dana Vachon. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
Thanks, Tanya.
Wonderful talking to you.
So in reading this book, the thought that crossed my mind is that you all had way too much fun writing it together. Is that true?
Yeah, we are both very exploratory and inventive people. And we started talking. We had a long conversation that lasted a few years and eventually evolved into this kind of explosion of ideas and apocrypha about my life. And we decided that memoirs just aren't where it's at because they're kind of fictitious anyway.
And when you say a few years, I mean, you're talking 8 years. That's a long time.
Start to finish with, I mean, I think conversation, we see it as a beautiful conversation. And there were the first 2 or 3 years were pure conversation, which I think you needed to have to build the trust that would then be required for like 2 years of intense writing together.
I had no idea I was being mined.
So you all met on Twitter about a decade ago at the beginnings of Twitter, really. And this friendship turned into the mining, as you said, the thinking about what this book would be. But how did you all come together in this idea of putting it in this way?
I think that we came to the conclusion at a certain point, what are we doing? We want to do something, you know, and all of these wild creative ideas were coming. And we went, you know, this is better than reality, you know, as has been proven throughout history, you know, everything's been embellished, everything from American history to King Arthur's story.
We have a friend who's a brilliant professor of medieval literature at Sarah Lawrence named Jillian Adler. And we were talking about the book and how by creating something quite surreal, but fixing elements of reality in it, celebrities, you actually gain the ability to paint a truer portrait. She said, you know, guys, you're not the first ones down this path. Dante did it in the Inferno.
Yeah.
And I think we ended up composing an Inferno.
We get asked a lot what people are going to think, what the celebrities are going to think about being in the piece. And this is a time-honored tradition. You know, it goes back to Dante and the Divine Comedy. He used the contemporary celebrities of the day to populate that book.
And Inferno was on our mind from the beginning, because when we met, Jim had just done a painting of Malibu in flames.
Oh, that's right. You are a painter.
You know, that's where the book's heading. So the image of fire and of apocalypse was cardinal from the outset.
I want to touch on some of the things in the book. We laugh because the main character is a man named Jim Carrey, but it's not exactly you. But then it is you. I mean, through satire, you two touch on the current issues in Hollywood, like cultural appropriation, for instance, white actors playing people of color. But then there are other parts of this book that are resonant and of the moment. I mean, the quest to stay relevant. It's a universal feeling that's only heightened by social media. What do you think, Jim?
Social media came in a few years back and basically lit everybody up with the same desire, the same obsession with relevance, hoping for complete strangers who have no idea who you are to press your subscriber button. And so everybody became Truman at a certain point. Everybody has their own bubble.
Except
own
Truman, Truman got meals and healthcare.
And I was, you know, I always get asked, what do you think happened to Truman when he left the bubble? You know, and I always say, well, what happened in real life? Everybody on the outside decided to go inside the bubble. Ultimate loneliness is this hyper-connectedness, but we never really get to know the real people because they're forming themselves by the likes of others. So this Jim Carrey in the book represents that. It represents ego, represents dealing with the extreme weather patterns of fame. It also represents the mistaken ideas that the readers have about what fame is and what it might be like.
Right, right.
People have no idea. And I'm not saying it's a negative because I could never stack my life up as a negative, but I will say that it's an extraordinary event that happens to very few people when everyone knows who you are wherever you go.
You know, one of the early images, the root of fame is fama, which is rumor. To be spoken about is to be famous. And there's a description in the Aeneid of what fama is, which is this very frightening bird where under every feather is an eyeball and a mouth. Fame is a very frightening thing. And I think that to have navigated it as successfully as Jim has gives him a lot of authority to describe it in the way that we've chosen to here.
Yeah. Do you, like the character Jim Carrey in this book, also worry about your relevance?
There's been times it's mostly, and I can't say I don't, but you start out with a team and you're fighting against the world with that team. And at a certain point, that team has other agendas, you know, and then their agenda becomes you're getting outside the box. It's hurting you. People think you're crazy. And I go, well, do you think, I don't think it's that crazy to be concerned about children who are being shot in their schools. Is that a crazy thing now?
Because they have you in this box of being a comedian, the person that makes us laugh.
Yeah. And we know you this way, so don't be another way. We, you know, it's partly my fault. It's anybody who gets famous's fault. We sell the world a character and we make them believe it's a constant. And no character can be a constant. No form of behavior can be a constant.
And in fact, it's a fiction, which is one of the reasons why fiction is the best way to treat that creation, that persona.
I want to ask you about that, Dana. So there's a lot of human emotion coming through comedy. For example, the character Jim Carrey does an adaptation of a hungry, hungry hippo opposite of a rhino who is digitally created. It's a version of the late Rodney Dangerfield. What was the process of writing what feels like an absurd storyline to tell what seems to be genuine feelings?
Well, I think we were engineering there a portal so that when the character Jim Carrey passed, it goes into that production chamber, the reader is also entering a place of uncertain reality. And I think what we found as a writing team was that once we entered the chamber, we were living in this place of real, unreal as well. You know, we thought that it would be fairly quick. And one day Jim said, I don't know what you thought we were doing for the next 2 days, but Rodney Dangerfield is back among the living and we're writing Rodney bits. Which
I'm walking around the living room going, hey, you know what I mean?
Which is always a fun way to spend a couple of days. Hey, I tell you, you know, I don't gonna get no respect at all, man.
But Jim, you had a personal relationship with Rodney Dangerfield. So this was very much real, but in this other way.
The emotion couldn't help but come through. We were trying to deal with these things that are super serious things for me in this absurdist way. And yet the emotion can't help but come through. He was such a strong influence. He was such a light. And, you know, I felt so lucky to be on the inside and to be admired by somebody like that.
Yeah. Another question. So I was the most idealistic about this world and in life in general. I was in my 20s in the 90s, and you were on Oprah, and you talked about how you would visualize your future, and you wrote this check for yourself as a broke actor for $1 million, which of course then you were able to cash years later. And I just remember the brightness of your face. But more than 20 years later, I mean, in reading this book, I don't know if we would call it pessimism, but your realism is right in line with kind of the decline in optimism that I have in our world. I'm hopeful for the future, but I'm wondering, are you still that bright-eyed guy from back then?
Yes, absolutely. I believe in the universe. I have magic happening at this very moment. This whole experience is not only did I get a best friend, but I got to places I never imagined possible. And this keeps happening to me. It keeps happening in every realm. I walk away seemingly from my audience, but I've never walked away from my audience. I have asked them for a lot, and they've given me a lot of understanding. Mm-hmm. I think at this point, when I kind of like go off on a journey, people go like, well, Jim's doing a journey, man. You know, it's like he's climbing another mountain. He's going to come down with some nugget of some sort and, you know, tape it on to the rest of the parade float.
Jim's one of the only people where if he released a straight memoir, many would say, what happened?
Really? Yeah. Yeah.
And so I've had this wonderful journey.
You gain best friends in each other. Do you see yourselves working together on another project?
I think that's inevitable, you know.
Yeah.
So it's been a fantastic experience in every way, intellectually, spiritually. Even when in the hardest of times, creatively, when we were bashing our heads together, and it happens, you know, we're two really strong-headed individuals, and we have our visions. And so every once in a while, that would be a conflict. But every time out, in the end, we came up with something even more extraordinary than either of us had initially conceived.
Which is magic.
Every single time, without fail.
Yeah.
You know, we went to bed some days just, you know, kind of crippled emotionally.
We can't end on that, but crippled emotionally, but now you're on the New York Times bestseller list. So congratulations there.
So
hold on. Thanks.
Somewhat of a salve for the situation.
Well, Jim Carrey and Dana Fashan are the co-authors of Memoirs and Misinformation. Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Nice. Thank you, Tanya. I appreciate it so much.
Hear my full interview with Jim and Dana. We had a lot of fun. Go to hereandnow.org. President Trump has released a memo calling to exclude unauthorized immigrants from the census numbers that decide how many congressional seats each state gets. The move is more likely to spark legal challenges than a change to the national headcount. The Constitution requires the census, which determines how those seats in Congress are divided up, to include every person living in the country. And it is Congress, not the president, who has final authority over the census. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports on all things census-related and joins us now from New York. And Hansi, what does the president's memorandum say?
Well, this memorandum directs the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, who oversees the Census Bureau, to include in the legally required report of census results, to include that report, information that would allow President Trump to exclude unauthorized immigrants from the numbers, the census numbers used to reapportion congressional seats. But like you explained, the Constitution says that every person living in the country should be counted and included in those numbers.
And the Trump administration lost the battle to include the now blocked citizenship question on the 2020 census. So how would they even know how many unauthorized immigrants are in each state?
That's a very good question. And this memo does not provide any explicit instructions, but it does refer back to an executive order that President Trump issued last year, about a year ago, came about after the administration couldn't add a citizenship question and directed agencies to provide the Census Bureau with government records in order to determine a number of citizens, non-citizens, including unauthorized immigrants in the country. But it's unclear exactly how the Bureau will do that and whether or not those numbers would produce results that could be used for reapportioning seats in Congress.
What exactly does the Constitution say about the census?
Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution, the sixth sentence of the Constitution, empowers Congress to carry out the, quote, actual enumeration, unquote, of people living in the country in, quote, such manner as they shall by law direct. You know, keyword, in that sentence, a sentence before that sentence is persons. There's no mention of citizens, and it's a number of persons living in the states that should be counted once a decade. And the 14th Amendment goes further. It specifies the whole number of persons in each state, which put an end to counting enslaved people as 3/5 of a person. This is how the country has come up with the numbers used to divide up seats in the House of Representatives. And this has been the way since, including citizens and non-citizens, regardless of immigration status, has been the way since 1790, the very first U.S. Census.
With the 30 seconds I have with you, counting for the 2020 census is already underway. What would an order like this mean for that count?
This could put out a really big chilling effect. Right now, about 4 out of 10 households are left uncounted. Many of them are households including unauthorized immigrants. The Bureau is trying to reach out to them, trying to gain their trust to collect their personal information. And federal law prohibits personally identifiable information from being released for 72 years, and it can't be used against a person. But this memo here that specifies unauthorized immigrants being left out could be misconstrued and could really hurt the count.
NPR's Hansi Lo Wong covers all things census-related. Thank you, Hansi.
You're welcome.
More than 610,000 people around the world have been killed by the coronavirus, and there are more than 14 million COVID-19 cases worldwide. COVID-19 is surging in the U.S., which has more cases and more deaths than any other country. Our next guest says the coronavirus has the potential to get much, much worse if the U.S. doesn't act now. And he has a chilling comparison. Historian John Barry is a professor at the Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine and the author of many books, including what's considered the book on the 1918 flu, The Great Influenza, the Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History. He's been a frequent guest, and it's good to have him on again on Skype from New Orleans. John Barry, welcome back.
Good to be back.
And you wrote an op-ed this week with your eye on the flu epidemic of 1918. So just remind us, this is the chilling part. How many people died then and when there was a resurgence of that flu epidemic?
Well, the total was 50 to 100 million worldwide. If you adjust for population, it would be between 220 million and 440 million today equivalent. Fortunately, this virus is not nearly as lethal as 1918. So even in a worst case, we're not looking at those numbers, but I think a worst case is certainly in the tens of millions worldwide.
Well, and here's the chilling part. It's all chilling, but when you look at this worst case, you say they actually did a better job of shutting down in 1918 than we're doing now?
They didn't do a great job, but I think anyone, frankly, did a better job than what the United States has done. Cities in 1918, almost all of them shut down. Many of them did reopen too soon, and they did close back down. Partisan politics was not an issue. Right. There were political issues, but they related to the war. If you look around the world, we are by far the worst developed country in the world by an enormous margin. You know, Italy is a population of over 60 million people, and they have fewer than 200 new cases a day right now. Florida, 20 million population, has been over 10,000 cases a day recently. And it is out of control in Florida. It's not almost out of control. It is out of control.
Well, when you say that, you know, they did not fabulous, but better in 1918 in addressing this, there was fear. People had sick family members they were caring for. you know, this was, as you say, wartime, World War One, and people stayed home from work 50%, and that eviscerated the economy, but at least for a time, most people thought that was the right thing to do. They did reopen. They had to close a second time, and in some places a third time. But we remember some of the stories, I think, mostly from your book. I mean, people who were loud talking, I think I read, people who had big, boisterous voices here in the Boston area, they were fined, you know, for spreading more virus through their blasts of sound. A town in Colorado surrounded itself and kept people out. You cannot come in. There did seem to be places where people really took it seriously.
Every place took it seriously in 1918, chiefly because the virus was more lethal. So everyone knew it was real. And again, if your neighbor is dying 24 hours after the first symptom, you know it's not ordinary influenza. So everyone took it seriously in 1918.
That seems like an interesting difference too, John Barry. I've said this a couple of times, and there are some people like Lori Garrett, infectious disease expert. She gets a little riled by this notion, but it does feel as if people were dying in homes on either side of you or upstairs, you know, if you're in triple deckers, you're seeing it. You're seeing people quickly succumb, not be able to breathe. Here, we're not seeing that death that much. It's locked away in hospital wards with ventilators. We're not allowed in. There's some footage that, you know, CNN has done some incredible reporting, but we're really kind of not seeing it the way they did.
Well, unfortunately, you know, the news of refrigerated trailers backing up because there's no room in the morgue, that is happening now. And people are beginning to take it seriously. One of the biggest differences between 1918 and now, at the beginning in 1918, there was practically no resistance to orders to wear masks, for example. Over a period of time, as people got tired of doing it, particularly after a city reopened and then reimposed various orders, some resistance developed. Not that much. Here we're getting the reverse. As we proceed and it becomes more and more apparent that this is real and it is serious, there is less and less resistance. So hopefully we will get to the point where that will be universally accepted in this, and it will be very unusual for someone to be out not wearing a mask.
Which it is in some places. I mean, it is where I am. It just, you just don't see anyone not wearing a mask. You're saying that will help and that happen elsewhere. But what about goals for reopening? You remind us none were met. It was recommended we keep the shutdown until there was a steep drop in cases. That didn't happen. We needed widespread compliance. Kids went to COVID parties. Some are now dying. And we were supposed to get 100,000 out-of-work people, maybe 300,000, some analysts said, to mobilize and do testing so that people who tested positive could be isolated and their contacts traced, also isolated. That never happened. How does that resonate with what happened in 1918? The idea that health officials set goals, none were met.
Well, of course, 1918 was very different. We didn't have the science. One thing they did do was run experiments on masks and how far droplets spread and so forth and so on. Those were very good experiments. But this is such a different situation where you have a culture war in the middle of a public health emergency. It's just crazy. You have people today still calling this thing a hoax related to attempts to defeat Trump. You know, what do you expect to happen? But exactly what is happening? Probably the worst thing about it is if we don't get this thing under control in the near future, it could get significantly worse. You know, people talk about, oh, you can't destroy the economy to contain the virus. Well, the way you destroy the economy is by not containing the virus. If Florida had 65 new cases a day, which would be the per capita equivalent to Italy, the economy would be operating full bore. Nobody would be debating whether or not to reopen schools because it would just be assumed. It wouldn't be a debate. The schools would be open. And, you know, the University of Florida football team and Florida State and University of Miami would all be ready to start practice. Instead, they did it the wrong way. They didn't take it seriously. And now it is out of control. When you have a week to wait for a test result, that's effectively not doing anything to contain spread. If you want to get the economy moving again, you need to intervene.
I'm thinking, John Barry, about all the conversations we've also had about your other expertise, which is flooding. Is there a comparison here? Have you been thinking of flooding?
Well, I'm talking to you from New Orleans, so it's hurricane season. Somebody asked me once if I compared pandemic to a hurricane or floods, and I said, well, you know, only in the sense that you know they're coming, but you don't know when and you don't know how bad it's going to be. So in that sense, there's a connection. In terms of leadership, it's a lot easier in a flood because everybody can see that the water is there, and nobody is going to tell you that a prediction of a hurricane storm surge is a hoax. They're going to get out of the way. So the whole emergency management process is easier in the sense that you're going to immediately have cooperation from the public. They all know what's coming. This, of course, should have been like that. Instead, it's been politicized. The politics is beginning to be drained out of it. You know, the governors and states that refuse to mandate it, even they say, well, you should wear a mask. As I said earlier, that's one of the strange things about it. This is that masks are different from 1918 anyway. The mask usage is increasing as opposed to decreasing.
Because so many more did it in the beginning. Boy, I think you're onto something. Let's just change this and call it, say, a flood is coming. Go home.
Yeah.
Wear a mask. And you might get some reaction. John Barry, professor at the Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine, author of many books, including The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History. And we'll link you to his recent op-ed at herenow.org. The pandemic could get much, much worse. We must act now. John, speaking to us by Skype, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Before anyone knew what to call COVID-19, some U.S. politicians, including President Trump and journalists, dubbed it the Chinese virus. Those early labels fit into a long-ignored history of anti-Asian racism in the United States. And many Asian and Pacific Americans fear that people who even look Chinese will continue to be possible targets of racist attacks. Cassandra Basler from member station WSHU reports.
An Asian student got punched in the jaw in Midtown Manhattan in early March. She told the WABC reporter she wanted to remain anonymous as she recalled being attacked by a woman on the street.
I remember exactly what she said. She said, "Where is your mask, you coronavirus b-?" And right after that, she just punched my chin. So I was really shocked.
It's one of several incidents since the coronavirus spread in the U.S. that prompted investigations of bias attacks. The NYPD arrested two anti-Asian hate crime suspects that same month, one who police say shouted expletives and pushed a father, another they say yelled anti-Asian comments and kicked a man. 2 days later, at a White House press briefing, ABC reporter Cecilia Vega asked President Donald Trump,
"Why do you keep calling this the Chinese virus? There are reports of dozens of incidents of bias against Chinese Americans in this country. Your own aide, Secretary Azar, says he does not use this term. He says ethnicity does not cause the virus. Why do you keep using this?
A lot of people say it's racist." "It's not racist at all. No, not at all. It comes from China."
A leaked Republican communications memo outlined a talking point strategy that directed blame for the coronavirus away from the president and towards China. The president was already backpedaling.
"There was a tweet where he said, don't blame Asian Americans for this."
Rita Pinarens is executive director of the OCA, Asian Pacific American Advocates, in Washington, D.C. That tweet she mentioned from the president drew strong criticism from prominent Asian American journalists. CBS White House correspondent Weijia Jiang tweeted with emphasis that Trump wrote, "Asian Americans need our protection." She noted Trump then tweeted, "They are helping us," as if Asian Americans are not also one of us. Or as Rita Pinarens says,
"There's been a long-standing feeling that we have not been fully accepted as Americans, that we have been perpetually stigmatized as foreign and other.
And Pin Aarons wants Trump to take action against anti-Asian bias.
We need to have an executive order forming another task force that looks at this problem across the country.
But she isn't waiting around for that to happen. OCA works with several other nonprofits to collect stories of anti-Asian hate nationwide.
There hadn't been too much activity in hate incidences before COVID-19. And so I think within the last few months, we've certainly seen a spike.
One of their partner groups is Stop Asian American and Pacific Islander Hate. The group tracked these incidents from March through mid-June and counted more than 2,000 in the U.S. They spiked when Trump started to call the pandemic the Chinese virus. Over 800 incidents were reported in California and nearly 300 in New York.
Everything from being taunted by strangers that we have coronavirus to spitting and physical assaults on our elders and our children.
The data show who's been targeted. Pin Aarons says that helps determine where to focus solutions, like bystander intervention training.
Women were three times more likely to have a hate incident than men were. Now, is this because women are more likely to be out doing the grocery shopping or out in the community? You know, is it that people feel that, you know, they're more vulnerable?
She hopes this data fills the gaps, so harassment that falls short of a police hate crime investigation can at least be tracked. It's hard to prove a crime was motivated by bias. And the Department of Justice says more than half of hate crimes don't get solved because they don't get reported.
People aren't always comfortable reporting because they don't know what happens to the data. Also, they're not quite sure what can be done afterwards.
Even if police could do more, would a hate crime survivor feel any safer? Some restaurant workers in New Haven, Connecticut struggle with this. A server at a Lao and Thai eatery called Pho Khet Khao noticed someone shattered her car windshield during her shift in April. Christine's son is the manager and daughter of the store owner. She says her mother also found a large dent on her car.
My first thought was, I think it had to be because they're Asian. We're the only store on that block that's open right now, and we happen to be an Asian restaurant. They can't classify as a hate crime because they don't have proof, but, you know, it adds up.
The New Haven Independent News reported the vandalism as a possible hate crime. Then supporters on social media raised more than $1,000 to help with car repairs. Still, Sun urges everyone of Asian descent to be hyper aware of their surroundings, especially her mother.
My cousin, who used to manage the restaurant, actually bought her pepper spray for her birthday this past year. So she has that.
Sun says a group of teenagers recently mugged her mother in the parking garage near her restaurant. Whether or not that incident was hate related, the restaurant workers are scared. They don't like to park on the street, and they keep scanning the storefront windows. For Here and Now, I'm Cassandra Basler.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.